Hey everyone, welcome to the Sneaker History Podcast, where we dive into the people, stories, and iconic moments that have helped make sneakers a global phenomenon. If you've ever told someone that you like their kicks, then you're in the right place. Before we lace up this episode, here's a little teaser for you. Stick around to the end of each episode for the last shot question. It's a chance to test your sneaker knowledge and engage with our community. I've also recently started a newsletter to share my knowledge from nearly two decades of experience working in the footwear industry. You can find the link to that below or go to sneakerhistory.com/newsletter for a weekly deep dive into the biggest topics in the sneaker business. All right, now that the business is taken care of, grab your favorite pair of kicks and let's get started with the episode.
Jordan trying to shake off Starks. Oh, what a move! Oh,
LeBron James with no regard for human life.
12 seconds. Bryant for the win. Bang!
Iverson against Gil. The crowd on its feet. Allen for the win.
Sneaker History Podcast.
What up? Welcome back to the Sneaker History Podcast. My name is Nick Engvall, and I'm here with my guys, Mike and Robbie. What's going on, fellas? How you doing?
Man, I'm doing good. How are y'all doing this evening?
I'm doing great. I'm over here singing songs and serenading my cool gray fours. I think that I plant.
Yeah, I didn't pick up Cool Gray 4s, but I definitely will be keeping my eye out for any kind of discount that shows up as a possibility.
Me and you both.
You have the OGs? Did you ever have the 04s?
No, I never got them, man. That's one of the few 4s that I didn't get that I actually wanted. So it's definitely on the list, but I'm trying to cut back. Yeah, keyword trying.
Yeah, the Spider Mitchell shoes on Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, I got those for, I got 20% off of those, so they end up being $80 anyway. So, you know, I couldn't pass on
value.
It.
That's the thing that makes it hard to say and be like, oh, but this is such great value. I have to get it right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of a side note to those fours, Bay Area Got Soul has been having like a discussion about how bad the Cool Gray 4s are, and they're not even a top 15 Jordan 4. So if you're listening to this, leave us some feedback either in the comments or rating section on your favorite listening platform or on Instagram of whether you think the Cool Gray 4s are even a top 15 Air Jordan 4. So once you start counting through them, start adding up quick. But I don't necessarily agree with their listing. So this, do a mental run through and tell us either on your listening platform of choice or Instagram what you think is a good Jordan 4 or if it even ranks up there.
Yeah, that's a good one because, you know, for me, just thinking quickly about it, all the OGs obviously are up there for me. The True Blues, probably number one for me. The Blacks, Black Red, Black Cement, whatever, probably number two. White Cement's probably number three.
Fire cool. Red.
Cool Grays. Cool Grays are right up there with Fire Reds to me, though. But Oreos are pretty good, too.
That'd be my top 10. I'm sitting there thinking, too. So I just like Nick, I got all the OGs up there. I had a couple of random ones I like. The Fear 4s and then the Cal 4s. Yeah, Cool Grays still make my top 10.
So how about this? Would you rather have the Cool Gray 4s or the Glow Green 4s from like 2011?
I like the Cool Grays a little bit better. I say the Glow Greens would be right after the Cool Grays for me.
Yeah, me too. Cool Grays. So one of the things that it shouldn't make such a difference, but it does to me, the rear heel tab on 4s always like just messes with my heel. So anytime it's not plastic, I actually like it better, which I know is like blasphemy probably to most people. So like the Cool Gray 4s have that, like, you know, it's like a softer material. So it doesn't irritate like the back of my foot if I wear it with short socks. Like most of the time I'm wearing them long socks anyway, but I would prefer short socks. So I don't know.
This year's has a soft tab, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So I think that's like the deciding factor.
Oh, I was gonna say those things are. Like, I don't have personally have ankle problems with them, but I can see they're like little razors on the back of your shoe.
Yeah, no,
for three shoes to me. I mean, it's different for every shoe, but these come with the Jumpman on the back, and a lot of people will hate on pretty much any Jordan now, the 3, 4, 5, or 6 that has the Jumpman on the back. I grew up with the Jumpman. I'm cool with it.
Like, I don't care. And I'm going to hate being charged an extra $30 with just the Nike Air on there. Like, what's the difference?
Right?
Yeah.
The quality is really nice, though.
Yeah.
It's nice.
That's the key to me is, like, if the quality is good, I'm good with it. I mean, it's nice to have, I think with, like, the 3s, I really love black cements with the Nike Air on the back. Ideally, yeah, like the Nike Air is nice, but it's not a deal breaker to me if the shoe is good quality and a good colorway.
Agreed.
So before we get into the rest of the episode, I wanted to first shout out, let's see, Andrew Keefe for leaving us a review on iTunes. We definitely appreciate you guys leaving review. It helps us reach out and grow our community here. And that's what we're trying to do. We're enjoying having the conversations and hopefully you guys are enjoying it as well. So if you have a second, leave us a review on iTunes, or if you're interested in supporting in a little bit bigger of a way, you know, go over to patreon.com/sneakerhistory and look at some of the options there, and you can support and grab yourself some t-shirts, stickers, that kind of thing on a monthly basis. And that'll help us even more, upgrade our equipment, all that kind of stuff. So we appreciate you guys. And yeah, that's about it.
Woo! 41 reviews on Apple Podcasts. That's so good. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate all you guys.
So this episode, we've got some Yeezy supply conversation to get through. We've got some tax evasion tactics from Nike, and what else? Some Puma news, because apparently Puma's like blowing up or something.
Booming.
But I think Yeezy supply is where it's at, which is where we should start at. Which is kind of funny because it's almost like not an actual story; it's just a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it, man.
My wallet trying to explode.
Well, when I got the email, I thought my phone wouldn't load all the way because I'm like, where's the picture at? What's coming tomorrow? And I kept refreshing my phone like a doofus. I'm like, come on, what is it? Show me a picture. Show me a picture.
Right? I mean, I almost don't want to tell listeners so then you won't be my competition. But
well, I mean, they won't get the podcast until after the drop, so it's fine. It's after the
fact. Okay, good point. I'm now open to talking about.
So basically Adidas.com and YeezySupply.com both have supposedly, this is the rumor, according to Kick It With Didi on Instagram, is the first place that came up for me. After closing one of their warehouses, they finally decided to restock these shoes to the public. Countdowns are set for tomorrow. And some of the info on some of the shoes dropping. According to this, OG gray Yeezy 750, cream Yeezy 350, black and red V2 350, static 350s, zebra 350s, black 700s, beluga 1.0s, and yellow 350s. I mean, it would be bananas if they actually restock some stuff, but I think realistically there's probably not very many of any of those if that's the case. But I don't know. I think this is kind of crazy because if it just putting this out there, if you subscribe to our Patreon, we put a little bit of a conversation before every episode on our Patreon as we talk through the topics for this episode. And one of the things Robbie was talking about was, you know, the prices of shoes and how people can move the shoes, how a new release or a restock can drive down the prices of the resale market. Right. I find this fascinating because if this restock information goes out, I bet you prices on goat and whatever are dropping at least a little bit, right? Because if it's real and stuff gets restocked, potentially all of these shoes that are restocking just lost a huge amount of value. Now, I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But also, Robbie needs a size 12 in 750s, so.
Not that resale price either, just like a helpful hand price.
Like a $10 finder's fee. That's all he got. Like, he was plus 10.
Maybe 20. That's where I'm maxing out.
Well, my thing is this. So if these cream Yeezys are dropping again and they were already mass released, you might as well be giving these things away for free, because if they drive down the price anymore, I mean, they're going to be basically like a sale price. You walk into any like big box store.
True. And that's awesome. Like,
it's good for me.
It's good for you. It's good for me. It's good for everybody who wants the shoe, because I'll keep talking about it. Yeezy wanted to have his shoes be accessible. And if he wants to keep restocking it, power to him. Like, I'm not about hating on a guy for sticking to his word. If he were banking on all these shoes being hyper valuable forever, he kind of gave you a warning before they started dropping.
Yep.
And like, the reason why I'm so fascinated by it is because I love the 700. That's a fantastic looking shoe. No other sneaker, luxury or athletic brand looks like it. So I'm very interested at like the 300 price point, whatever it releases at, 350 and 1,000. It's just straight up economics. It's not hard. But this, I try to think of, I talk right now like my hopes are up, but I've tried to purchase many shoes in my life. It's not going to work out where I get everything I want. And that's okay. But just the idea of him doing it, I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's awesome to see him really sticking to his word and getting as many, getting him on as many people as he possibly can. Cause that to me is kind of in itself, like bucking the system, so to speak, where, you know, it's, we know how the game works, right? Like Nike and Jordan Brand perfected it, you know, whatever, 7-8 years ago. And now they've kind of oversaturated the market for a lot of the retros. Like the Cool Grays, if they released in 2012 or 2013, 14, maybe, they would be reselling for $300-$400. But because Jordan Brand has so many shoes out there now, and you know, it's not to say that it's bad either, right? Because if they're selling all these shoes, even if they're selling them at a discount, they're making more money off of them. Where if they're limiting them, then it's just the secondary market making money off the shoes. So I'm excited to see what happens from this. I think it's really interesting, and I think it's also really interesting to think about how, you know, the brands or, you know, collaborators kind of can control the secondary market and play with the secondary market without even mentioning it, right? Because at the end of the day, like all these platforms that are trying to have people resell shoes, you know, if any of these brands or collaborators that are making the shoes wanted to just flood the market with shoes, it wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing if they have the reach and the audience to sell the shoes like Kanye does. Like, I mean, okay, yeah, you would have shoes that sell for maybe below retail on some of the platforms, but your actual retail partners are going to sell for retail or really close to it, regardless of what you sell. And more people are going to have access to it, because despite what all of us sneakerheads think of us being the most important piece of the footwear business, we're not, right? Like there's 80% of the world doesn't pay attention to when Yeezys release. Maybe that's a little bit, you know, less now. Maybe it's 70% of the world doesn't pay attention. But still, that's a huge percentage of the world that doesn't care when a Yeezy releases, but they'd probably buy one if they saw it available for retail.
True. Yeah, why not? I mean, it's one of those things, you walk into the store, just like, you know, someone who buys sneakers, just like a normal person, not like us. Like, oh, this is cool. Oh, and it's for sale? Heck yeah, I'm going to buy it. Or, hey, isn't that a terrible price? Cool. Because I'm looking, so if these 750s actually release, I'm really curious to see if the OG 750, the gray, actually gets under this ridiculous price tag of, like, ranging between $1,300 and $6,000 on StockX. If they release, like, a good amount of them, I want to see if it just plummets, because that's insane for this thing to be that much money.
Well, Nick was just saying the price being dropped down on the secondary platforms. You can go to GOAT or StockX right now and buy any of the 700s that have released recently for like $20 to $30 less than retail, which is $300.
So $270.
And that's a good deal. I mean,
well,
go ahead.
Look at the 750s, the originals. Like the 700s have been in a spot where they're not looking to, unless you're the Wave Runner, they haven't been keeping value. But I didn't realize that the 750s, the original high tops, were like had such a high resale price on them. I don't see people wearing them, to be honest. I've seen a couple of people in the streets in the black ones or brown ones, but I didn't know that these ones carried such an amount to them.
Because they're in people's closets collecting dust, trying to make money. And that's why sneakers suck sometimes. Like, you'll never see them in the streets, but somebody will have an Instagram picture with 14 pairs around them.
To me, like, the 750 isn't as wearable of a shoe, and I think that's why it was more limited. It wasn't as appealing as the Wave Runners or as any of the 300, 350, or, you know, 350, 350 V2s, right?
Yeah.
It's a much more like fashion forward shoe. So to me, it's there's a lot of variables that drive that price up. But I think that, you know, also the fact that it's the very first shoe that Kanye made with Adidas or released with Adidas has a little bit of effect on that price. And even though we look at it now and we see like the 700s releasing for, or selling for below, you know, retail, that's not a bad thing for Adidas or Kanye. That's only a bad thing for, you know, people that paid full price for them and are trying to flip them, or maybe, you know, the platforms that are trying to take their 10% or whatever. Because if you look at, Jordans right now, like, I would say that, you know, just based on, oh, they're on sale, Jordan brand must be doing terrible. But we just talked about it on the last episode, like, Nike's up, what, another 7%, like $39 billion worth of sales. And if you were to look at the sneakerhead, if you were to look at the sneakerhead market, I would say that Nike is probably almost at a low point as far as relevancy. Not that there isn't like a huge amount of energy around it, but for them, we're used to them dominating every bit of the news cycle, every bit of the hype cycle. And now you've got Kanye stepping in every couple of weeks, dropping a shoe. You've got, you know, some of the other Adidas collabs that like Pharrell and that kind of do the same thing where they like, oh, okay, they hop in. And then you have Puma, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But like, all these brands are taking a little piece here and there of that traditional market. And Nike's still making a ton of money and their profits are still growing and their sales are still growing. Even though we look at it and we think, what the hell, you know, True Blue 3s for $80. I can't believe it.
Where do you see True Blue 3s for $80? Send me that link.
I mean, not now, but they were definitely, you know, around $100 at the outlets for a while. Right. So you get them on the hash wall with a 20% off and there you go. And I think like a lot of the Jordan retro product has been that way for quite a while now. Like even those, like, even like stuff like the sixes, Jimmy Butler colorway or whatever, you know, that shoe was super cheap. The Mochas were super cheap, not super cheap, but like 100, 120 range at the outlets. So, and to us, that means that Jordans are sitting, whatever, but reality is they're still making tons of money off those shoes.
When it costs you $5 to make them, selling them for $115 is still a good deal.
I don't know about $5, but yeah, it's definitely Well, I guess this will be a good point to transition into this second story, right? Where I guess Nike's been using offshore accounts in Bermuda to keep their profits rolling in. I don't know. This is
Nike's owned by rich white people. What?
What?
It is kind of crazy though, because it's all just a game, right? Like if you know how to play the game, then that's how you win. So this story is basically, I don't know if this is a public thing on, Portland Business Journals, or if it's like a private one where you've got to be subscribed, but essentially like European authorities say Nike benefited from illegal tax deals that helped it shift as much as $10 billion in profits to Bermuda. The company's defenders say the European Commission is singling out a favorite corporate punching bag and leading a misguided attack. I don't know. I don't know what to say about it.
I think we could have it as a thinking point for the listeners, because it speaks for itself. Not literally. We can talk about it.
Let me read a little bit more on this, because it's kind of interesting. Basically, what it is Bermuda does not tax corporate income, meaning the hoard of cash that went untaxed essentially was the income had been taxed at what was then a 35% U.S. corporate tax rate. It would have generated roughly $3.5 billion in tax revenue, money that, you know, obviously the government would like to have. But because it was claimed, said the Netherlands illegally gave Nike state aid by approving the arrangement, that now they're not paying taxes on that $3.5 billion in tax revenue. I mean, it's crazy. It's just insane. I don't know how, you know, obviously I'm not wealthy enough to know how to play these games, so I don't really know what to say about it, but that's a lot. That's a lot of money. And if you look at like the kind of graph that they have on this, that I'll share on like the stories on Instagram by the time you're reading this or listening to this. But basically, it went from 2006. Nike has consistently paid less than corporate income tax. The rate was 35% until 2018, when federal tax reform dropped the rate to 21%, and Nike's bills skyrocketed in 2018 to a one-time payment on offshore profits as a result from the tax reform. So essentially, in 93, they start out at about 38%. They're able to get it down to like roughly 35 by 2006, and it drops down to like 25% or so throughout like the mid 2000s, 2013. In 2017, it drops to 13%.
I feel like they can't beat up.
In 2017, it drops to 13%. And then 2018, it shoots up to 55% tax rate. So I don't know. It's insane.
I mean, I'm no tax expert, but those like big jumps, I feel like someone should notice that a long time ago.
You would think, man, but I don't know.
But then again, I feel like they're not the only people doing it. So I feel we're going to hear about the story today, and then that'll be it. They'll resolve it behind closed doors somewhere, because Nike pulls in too much cash. They'll be able to just put it under the rug somewhere. So, I mean, again, I don't have much to say on it. Again, I'm no expert on any taxes, but I'm sure they're not the only brand and business doing it.
Yeah, I think all businesses, you know, once they get to a certain size, take advantage of these things. I mean, you see it every day in you know, I mean, I think it's the why you have so many people that argue for like a flat rate tax or like higher taxes on corporations, because there's so many people pulling stuff like this where it doesn't seem fair. And I don't know. I mean, like, it's not like it's a, I guess, written, you know, like if the law is written that way and it has those loopholes, then you know, what else can you say about it, right? But
I don't think anything to come of this. I mean, do you guys think there's any going to be any like real repercussion that's going to come over Nike because of this?
Nope.
From the back of the room, Robbie.
No, I think all this stuff is just, you know, formalities, right? Where the brands, you know, even if they get a slap on the wrist for something like this, what's that mean? Oh, they give the government, you know, whatever, they'll settle out of court and pay a quarter of the fine or whatever that is. And, you know, who knows where that money goes anyway. I was just thinking about that because somebody, I forget what it was. Somebody just had to pay like a crazy fine. And it's like, what?
That was Facebook.
Yeah. Facebook. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, where does that money go? I mean, okay. You know, I feel like, you know, I'm obviously,
we all get a check. Everyone uses Facebook to get a check.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's, and even then, if they did that, there's so many people on Facebook, everybody get like a quarter.
Well, they pay what, $5 billion in like a fine or something. I could be wrong, but I thought it was somewhere north of $5 billion.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
But they were ready for it. They literally had to check it written out. They're like, who do we sign it to so we can make this go away?
Funny you say that. So the whole Equifax thing where people get $125 or credit monitoring if you were hacked in 2017. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, they ran out of money, didn't they?
That's what I was getting to. So like it's up to $125. The fund only has like $31 million in it. A couple hundred got affected. Think about that. So it's like there isn't enough money for everybody to get it. So I feel played. I probably got like 15 cents. And they did take my, like, I got hella breached, if that's the technical way of saying it. No, I got hella breached, though. And it's like, damn, I might get like 15 cents now. I should have got that monitoring.
On a good day.
Yeah.
So I just did like quick math. If Facebook was paying, if Facebook's $5 billion, if you just figured it's $5 billion flat and there's 170 million users in America on Facebook, everybody get like basically a $29.50 check.
Hey, that's lunch. You know, that's a good meal. I'll take it.
It's crazy though, but
I love you guys. My cat's laying amongst shoes, and it looks so cute. So
you got distracted by that.
So speaking of cats, no, not really. Okay. I don't have anything else on cats, but
they're a perfect segue.
The next story we wanted to talk about was, I guess these tariffs again from Donald Trump. Looks like another 10%, no, 25% on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods, which obviously would, you know, am I reading that right? It would obviously crush the footwear world. It's a new 10% on $300 or $300 billion in Chinese goods, which it was in May, it was 25% on $300 billion. And each time it's been different, but footwear primarily falls into these categories either case. So once again, there's a quote on Footwear News, no, on Portland Business Journals from Matt Priest, who's the CEO of the Footwear Distributors and Retailers of America, said, "We will not take this news lying down. President Trump's new tariffs should concern every American. 70% of every pair of shoes sold in the U.S. comes from China. Footwear from China is already hit with upwards of 67% duties. President Trump is, in effect, using American families as hostage in his trade war negotiations. Tariffs are taxes, and this move will noticeably raise the cost of shoes at retail and will have a chilling effect on hiring in the footwear industry." I don't know. Can't really argue with that.
Well, I call the... No, I was just going to say, I call that a industry-wide railing, but never mind.
Well, as Nick was giving those facts just now, I wanted to do a little checking to see what shoes I have that were made in China. So it looks like the Jordans are made in China, but from the couple of the sample size of Nikes I just looked at, like purely Nike, all made in Vietnam. So would that affect, it would look like it would affect Jordan brand over Nike in that aspect. But I mean, clearly it goes back to Nike as the parent brand, but it's just weird to see the separation.
Yeah, I think there's like a lot of, it's hard to say because a lot of the brands manufacture in different countries now, and it's diversified a little bit. But overall, you know, I would say that the big brands like Nike and Adidas, maybe Puma, and you know whomever else at that level, they're hit less with this. And it probably hurts the smaller companies that only have one, you know, factory that manufactures their shoes. And if they committed to China as their manufacturer when they started their brand and, you know, made partnerships with people there to make it work, now potentially a shoe that, you know, that they thought they would compete in like an, you know, average price point, or maybe they're like competing at $100 price point, this potentially could, you know, push it up to 130, 140. And, you know, it, thinking about like what we've been talking about tonight, if you're a new brand and you're putting your shoe in front of me at $130, that means you're competing with Jordan Retros, which that's not a good place for you to be.
Yeah.
Out of that kitchen.
Yeah.
From what we talked about in the previous episode, I feel like a lot of the owners and big investors of these sneaker companies are typically Republicans. I mean, that we know of. I feel like the president is kind of hurting his own cause to get reelected. And if he's going to put this crazy tax on these people, because they're not happy, they're not going to invest in his campaign, which in turn kind of lowers his chances of getting reelected. So I almost feel like it's counterintuitive to him, and then counterintuitive to his cause of, you know, raising American businesses, because a lot of these businesses like Nike, the biggest shoe brand in the world, is going to get one of the biggest hits. So I don't know. Seems kind of counterproductive all the way around here.
I mean, I think you would think that, but I mean, I don't know, without going too far down this rabbit hole of like the president and politics, like, I just don't think there's a lot of logic to his approach to doing things. I think he, you know, doesn't really think about the effects of any of the things that he says, as long as it gets a reaction from media outlets and, you know, potentially like, you know, other countries are like, oh my God, he said this, then that's what he wants. Right. And I think that, you know, I think that he's less about making things happen and making changes, and more about just staying in the news cycle, because as his presidency has gone on, you see him saying more and more ridiculous things, and we're all kind of numb to it, unfortunately, where it's like none of us are surprised at anything he says anymore. And so he, you know, ups the craziness a little bit each time, and also, you know, has gone from like two crazy things a week to now 6 days a week, he's putting something out there that completely, like, you know, changes what everybody's talking about on the news or on social media and all this stuff. And it's just like super chaotic. And I can't imagine being a footwear executive or in the footwear business on the manufacturing side and having to think about these things, because like just looking at this particular threat in, you know, over the last, what has it been, maybe 90 days, you have essentially like early May is when he, you know, first started making this crazy threat about 25% tariffs, which means if you're in the manufacturing side at one of these big brands, that's a huge chunk of change. Like that changes everything about the way you manufacture a good portion of your shoes. And then you don't know if that's going to go into effect. But if you're not planning for it, it's even worse. If you're like dismissive and it actually happens, then you're really, really screwed. So now you've made this drastic change at, you know, whenever it was, early June. And here we are, you know, what, 2 months later, you're back to this new drastic change that needs to be planned for, dealt with, or even reacted upon. And all of those things are, all those decisions are based on this reactionary, you know, kind of element to what you're doing as a business. And if you're in manufacturing, you know that you can't change your manufacturer. You can't change these things about manufacturing, because the time that it takes to go and actually create the samples and the products and go through that is a months long process. So to me, like, this is so much bigger than just like the tariffs. It's so disruptive for like capitalism in general that I don't see how any of these companies are going to be able to run smoothly for the next 6 to 9 months, because that's what they're working on right now. Even on the other side is like samples. Like, think about, like, let's say the Jordan 34, 35, they're probably on the 35 right now. So they're talking through and making samples and pieces of this shoe right now. And if their goal is to make it, you know, $175 shoe, then it's now $100 or $225 shoe. But how do they address that? You know, it's almost impossible.
Yeah. I mean, with that, all you can do is just, go ahead, Mike.
Go up. No, I was just going to say, yeah, all you do is end up slapping a price tag on there and just hoping people still.
It's like, with that turnaround time, it's so slow. Like Nick was saying, you're just totally screwed. Like, the product's already made. You can't go back and unmake it. Like, you're just going to have to pay that tariff. It's totally wild.
Yeah. There's an interesting quote from one of the articles that I was reading on this. It's from basically one of the vice presidents of Columbia Sportswear, which, you know, we don't necessarily think of them as like a footwear manufacturer, but they obviously make a lot of footwear. And the example that they give is about a year ago, they were the 53rd largest duty payer in the United States out of 350,000 importers, according to, and they were citing U.S. Customs data. And like, that's crazy to think that they're 53rd, because they are absolutely nowhere close to the 53rd largest company importing product in the country. Like, they're probably not even in the first 100,000 of the size of the companies. They do, like, you know, according to this, they do $2.8 billion in revenue, which, you know, like we were talking about, Nike's doing $37 billion in revenue. So this whole thing just, I mean, it's going to hurt those small companies so much. It's scary to me.
Shout out Columbia. They make my waterproof hiking boots.
Hey, I actually saw something.
Necessary item in Oregon.
Connected to this, I guess. I was going to say irrelevant, but it's actually relevant. I actually saw something recently that Columbia said they'd had one of their best years ever as a company. And so I lived in Oregon for a number of years when I was a kid, and we lived on by the Columbia River. Like, I used to go hang out and fish in the river and stuff when I was a kid. And to think that they had their best year, you know, as a company this year is kind of bananas, because this is the first year that they actually did streetwear collaborations. Like, I can't remember who, but they did For Sure Extra Large. And I want to say, like, maybe Ronnie and Kith did something with them. So it's
really,
it's kind of crazy to think how a company like that, who is not really relevant in, you know, sort of the streetwear sneaker game, can kind of dip their toes in it and see that much of a boom in their business to the rest of their business.
I feel like they're probably taking a page out of their competitor, North Face, because, I mean, they're definitely known for their streetwear collaborations. So, like, hey, if they can do it, heck, why shouldn't we do it and get in on this extra?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there was a Kith around Christmas time, I think. But I think, you know, stuff like that is so the nostalgia piece of it, because I think a lot of people recognize the Columbia Sportswear name, but don't necessarily have a connection to it. You know, like, obviously, if you're getting boots or something, that's a different story, because, mm-hmm. you know, I think everybody knows, or a lot of people know, they're kind of up there with North Face as far as that stuff goes. But they definitely haven't had a real presence in kind of the more modern streetwear, sportswear world.
What's funny is you say that, but I know that most people at one point of their life has had a Columbia jacket, either like a hand-me-down or like a something. At least in my experience, they just happen to come around.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's one of those like old school brands where, you know, you think of like the, I don't know, what's another one, like LL Bean or something like that, or like, you know, you just
Eddie Bauer.
Yeah. You just see it every once in a while and you're like, oh yeah, I do know what that is.
My mom's expedition.
yeah, exactly. So the last thing that we wanted to talk about, today was, this story. I guess there's two more things, huh? Maybe we'll save the extra, the Nike conversation for next time.
We could save one. Yeah.
Yeah. But, essentially like Footwear News just published something, actually not more than maybe a couple hours ago, that said that, Puma is booming. The first line of the article says, if small is the new big, Puma could be well on its way to being huge. The Germany-based brand managed to put up stellar earnings this week, with second quarter profits up nearly 60% on sales of 1.2 billion euros, which is about $1.3 billion. Although with seemingly less fanfare than competitors like Nike, Under Armour, and Adidas. So they credit this to the Ralph Sampson retro coming out. And I don't know if I feel like that's really the big story out of it, but to me, it's more about the RSX and all of those like chunky runners that were, I mean, they were like probably some of the first Pumas that I've seen sell out on their first release in forever. Yeah. And I would argue that basketball probably has something to do with it too. Like, I bought a pair of Puma, the Court Clydes or whatever they're called. And I haven't bought a pair of Puma, like, you know, like a new technical shoe from Puma or a new like technology shoe from Puma. I haven't bought anything in years. Like, I like all the retro runners and stuff, but nothing new for a long time. I don't know. What do you guys think about this whole thing? Just hype, or is Puma actually on a comeback trail?
They're on a comeback trail. I don't know how big they're actually going to be, but from I've heard from one connection I have that they actually take into huge consideration the stores that sell their product, like who sell at a high clip. That whenever they come out with a new product, they actually get them involved and get their actual input and make changes based on, you know, the majority input from these stores, which is really cool. Which, although like we spoke about before we got on the before we started recording, yes, we know we don't know if anything will actually sell till it does. But having that kind of input, or taking the input and actually using it, I think helps the cause a bunch. So if you have a bunch of people telling you, hey, this isn't going to work, and here's how you can change it, and it actually, I think that helps a lot, because these are people who literally know what's going on in the trenches. They deal with the customers every day. So I think that is one of the things that contributes to their success. And one of the shoes I actually been eyeing myself is this Liquid Sail, the sheer one that they've been pushing here, is like the Optic Sheer. I think there've been a couple of reviews on like YouTube and stuff, but I saw one in person, is actually a pretty cool shoe. So they're putting out some stuff that it may not sell out, but I'm sure that it's making some waves and moving some units.
I mean, I think it's the opposite of hype, because if this brand Puma is coming up with such good sales without having the name kind of in the news like Nike and Adidas, that just proves that they're a loyal fan base and a lot of freaking Europeans in these shoes, honestly. I just think of like Euro dude and like Puma suede and Roma's like drinking coffee.
Espresso. So
that's just like what
is that what you said?
Like a nice German dude having like a beer at 9 a.m. That's cool. And wearing his Pumas. It's a good life.
It's a good life, man.
I haven't bought a pair of Pumas, nor, I mean, I would be gifted a pair of Pumas, but like, I'm not trying to buy a pair. I'll happily take a pair. But like the RSX is like the only one I would legitimately wear. It looks really cool, kind of sporty. But outside of that, I haven't worn Pumas since like 2005. So it's been a hot minute. But I'm happy for them because competition is a good thing. Competition breeds like pushing the envelope and innovation. And having to like have your best foot forward. So I hope they keep pushing Nike and Adidas. I hope Under Armour finds a way to kind of rejuvenate the Steph line again and have them be competitive. Like it's just, it's good for everybody. So I would love to see that continue.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. And I'm kind of with Mike on the, like those LKD cell, whatever they're called, cell sheer optic or something. Like they have that like
a long name.
Yeah, they have like this these like translucent overlays, and it's just like the first colorway is just like insanely bright, which I'm all about. But I also saw there's another like black and gray with like hits of purple on it, which is coming out soon, which looks really dope too. And I think I think that it's like Robbie said, it's so good that all these companies are getting a little bit bigger of a piece, because the more diversified the stores are, then the more variety that you're buying as a consumer, the better the product is from every brand. And it forces all the brands to be more thoughtful in the way that they produce things and the way that they market things and the way that they sell things. And to me, like, that's like the best way for everything, because that's how you're going to get, you know, like 3D printed shoes from, you know, Under Armour, Adidas, and Puma, and then Nike going, oh, we're going to 3D print like knit. So now all these technologies are eventually going to come together on somebody's shoe, and you're going to have some crazy one piece shoe at some point in the next, you know, 2 years. So
yeah,
it's pretty crazy to see how much they're up though, because it does seem like they're relatively low key compared to Nike or Adidas.
Here's a wild thought, and it speaks to competition. So from like 2000 and probably let's say 2009 to 2015, if you bought a pair of Jordan retros, they were resellable very easily, but the leather was like plastic garbage, like literally like Glad bags. Like if you have the white infrared sixes, if you have any of the Jordan 2 retros, if you have any of the fives, the leather is god awful. But then once Adidas starts killing it in the lifestyle, oh, here comes that remaster. Here comes Jordan brand having a real dedicated, you know, like development process for their shoes. That competition from Adidas, I think, pushed them to go, okay, we're making retros, they're selling, but Adidas is also now selling a $180 shoe, and it's selling really well. So our $180 shoe should go to $190, and we need to start making it better. So
yep.
Maybe there's a correlation there. Maybe it's a fake correlation, but time-wise, it all matches up. So
yeah, no, I think that's a pretty good comparison. I think that
yeah, right on the nose, man. Yeah.
So So, I mean, I guess we should wrap on that. I don't know how we're going to top it. So,
I love Jordan. Don't get it twisted. I always love Jordan. I own those shoes. I talk shit, but I own those shoes from them. But I still bought them.
All right. Well, as always, we appreciate all of you for rocking with us, listening to us, and supporting us. And if you have any thoughts, comments, questions on this episode, hit us up on Instagram, leave us a comment, Twitter, DMs, whatever. We're available, and we want to try to have more conversations with you guys and get you more involved in the podcast as well. So you can reach us at Sneaker History on all the platforms. You can reach myself, Nick Engvall, on all platforms. Guys, how can they find you?
Man, you guys can find me, Mike Guillory, on sneakerhistory.com. You can also find me on the other parts of the internet at Twitter and Instagram under MadWatcher789.
Don't tweet me. I'm really bad at checking it. But you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at RAHBEE702. And that's just Robbie phonetically. So if you think about it, you already know my Instagram handle. So, yeah, thank you.
All right. We appreciate all of you, and we'll catch you next time. Peace.
See you.
Thank you.
What up, y'all? This is Nick again. Before you take off, I want to ask a few favors of you. First off, if you're still listening, I wanted to thank you for supporting us and continuing to listen to our podcast. If you're enjoying it, and I'm going to assume that you do if you're listening this long, please take a couple of minutes, head over to iTunes, drop us a review, leave a comment, make sure you're subscribed. It's the only way that we can really continue to grow our audience and reach new people and continue to grow the podcast. Second thing is, if you haven't already, head over to sneakerhistory.com/shop. You can pick up t-shirts, coffee mugs, stickers, and some other miscellaneous things. And all of these things go to help us continue this podcast and continue the site and just pay for miscellaneous expenses that come up. We're not trying to make a killing off of it, but it would be awesome to have your support. And who knows, maybe run into one of you on the streets one day rocking a Sneaker History t-shirt. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time. Peace. Hey, hey, Nick here again. Before you take off, I want to thank you for listening to the Sneaker History podcast. Be sure to hop into our Discord to answer this episode's The Last Shot question and get to know our community of sneaker enthusiasts. If you'd like more insights on the trending topics in the sneaker world, I've also recently started a newsletter to share my knowledge from nearly 2 decades of experience working in the footwear industry. You can find the link to that below or go to sneakerhistory.com/newsletter. And last but not least, tell someone you like their kicks today. You never know how far a simple compliment can take you, and we all know how good it feels to be on the receiving end of some appreciation. Thank you for all the support, and we will catch you on the next episode. Peace.